Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Will Falk. Will Falk is a former public defender turned grassroots environmental activist. His first passion is poetry. The natural world is speaking, and his work is an effort to listen. He currently lives in Park City, Utah. Today, we're going to talk about pinyon juniper forests. So first, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about this.
Where and what are pinyon juniper forests? What is pinyon?
Well, as the name suggests, pinyon juniper forests are natural communities characterized by two species of trees. The first tree, pinyon, are pinyon pine trees, and the second are juniper trees. And pinyon juniper forests, they live primarily in the Great Basin of the United States, but they stretch into other parts of the American Southwest. And I think to really understand what pinyon juniper forests are, we have to understand a little bit about the Great Basin, because in many parts of the Great Basin, pinyon pine trees and juniper trees, pinyon juniper forests are the only trees you'll find. So the Great Basin stretches across the state of Nevada, parts of western Utah, southern Idaho, a little bit of southern Oregon, and eastern California. And the name Great Basin, I think, you know, if this was 150 years ago, we would understand what a basin was a little more, but it basically refers to a kitchen sink. And the Great Basin acts like a giant kitchen sink. It's bounded on its east and west sides by tall runs of the Rocky Mountains. And then at the bottom are dry desert outdoors. And the reason that the Great Basin acts like a big sink is water in the Great Basin either evaporates or runs into underground wells or collects in giant lakes. Probably the most classic and famous of the Great Basin's lakes is the Great Salt Lake, not far from where I live. And water, the reason the Great Salt Lake is salty is because just like if you left water in your kitchen sink for millions of years, it would turn salty. The water in the Great Salt Lake hasn't been able to flow anywhere. It turns salty. So that all pertains to pinyon pine trees and juniper trees because these are trees that have become very harsh conditions within the Great Basin. The climate in the Great Basin is characterized by very dry and hot summers and very harsh, cold, and snowy winters. And the trees themselves are very hardy for being able to survive in a climate like this.
And no, I was going to say, I lived in northeastern Nevada, Carlin, for a couple years, and I remember days where it might get up to, because it's high desert, you might get up to 60 degrees in the day and go down to 10 below at night. And this is going to sound like an exaggeration, but I remember at dark watching the mercury fall in a thermometer. You could actually see it go down because it can get very, very cold and very hot, like you said.
Yeah, and that's... I love that you brought that up because one of my favorite things about the forests themselves are the way that they act as kind of microclimate modifiers or it's not the right word. They hold temperatures, and I recently was in Cave Valley, Nevada, which is sort of central Nevada around Eden. And It was so cool to me to be able to walk across the valley floor, and we were camping there for a couple days. So this was probably the third week of November, and there was a little bit of snow on the ground, but it got really cold at night. I think it got to about zero a couple of the nights that we were sleeping out there in sleeping bags. And one thing that I learned about the forests were you could be down on the desert floor where there was no trees and it was freezing down there. But as the morning gained strength and the sun came out and you moved up the mountains into the forest, it was actually warmer there because the heat reflected off the valley floor into the trees and the trees held some of that warmth. And I just couldn't help but imagine myself, if I had lived here, you know, for the last 1,000 years, how this would have just been one of the original joys of living in the Great Basin, being able to, go to the trees as your heat, for example. So I love that you brought that up. That's a really one of my favorite things that the trees do. And I guess that can spring me into talking about pinyon juniper forests as habitat for a number of different species, including 450 plant species actually share the land where you find pinyon pines and juniper trees. You'll find 450 other plant species living there in community with those forests. You'll also find 150 animal species and some very iconic Great Basin species like elk, mule deer, and bear, all pinyon juniper forests home for at least part of the year, if not the whole year. And then pinyon juniper forests are an absolute bird paradise for birds that pass through or live in the Great Basin. The trees are perfect for nesting and perching. Trees that have died and are hollow are perfect for drumming. There are several bird species in the Great Basin that part of their different ceremonies involve drumming on the trees. And then, of course, with all the juniper berries and the pine nuts that pinyon pines produce, birds have plenty to eat between berries, nuts, and insects in the forest.
And part of the reason, I mean, apart from these forests being just wonderful on their own and places people should know about, there are threats to these forests.
Absolutely. I think the most pressing and urgent threats and the ones that need to be talked about first come from governmental agencies, specifically the Bureau of Land Management and the United States Forest Service. Both the BLM and the Forest Service have policies that include what they call vegetation treatment projects. And vegetation treatment projects is the term that they've invented that simply is an abstract way of saying clear cutting, and that's an abstract way of saying murder. The BLM and the Forest Service right now have plans to clear cut potentially over 5 million acres of pinyon juniper forest throughout the Great Basin and other places through the American Southwest. The reason that they've come up with a series of justifications for why they want to do this, and I'll get to those in a second, but the important thing to remember is that the Bureau of Land Management and the United States Forest Service serve economic and corporate interests. They are the government's wing of capitalism in the Great Basin. And there are some fascinating studies well, I guess I shouldn't even call them studies. There's just fascinating facts about the formation of the Bureau of Land Management and the formation of the United States Forest Service, where these agencies were actually created to serve, in the case of BLM, specifically ranching interests across the Great Basin. And so before I address, and I will address some of the specific justifications BLM uses, it's important to remember that these justifications are simply hiding ranching interests. Where there's trees, livestock can't graze. And so ranchers are always jealous of trees. And whenever they can remove vast tracts of forest, they can run their livestock on those opened areas, and they stand to make money. So I am, as I was preparing to talk, I pulled up from the Bureau of Land Management's Carson City District Sierra Front Field Office a notice of the so-called treatment projects that they published in the fall for a region in the Virginia Mountains of Nevada. And I pulled up this notice because it has some of the classic justifications for deforestation that BLM uses. And I thought it might be helpful, or it might be a good way to talk about what BLM is doing, to just read some of these justifications and then kind of systematically undermine their reasoning with both science and with common sense.
That sounds great.
Okay. So the three.
Wait, let's back up before we start that.
Okay.
Can you describe, like, when, just so people can see it, when you say a juniper tree, I mean, obviously that's different than a redwood tree. And are these, how big are these trees? Can you give like a 20-second description of both pinyon pine and juniper?
Yes, I can. So pinyon pine. They are, when you think of the towering evergreens or the towering, we all have in our minds, when we think of evergreens, we think of the giant sequoias, the really tall redwoods, the firs. Pinyon pines, because they grow in this such a harsh environment, they're not reaching the same heights or the same girths as these other very large, very famous, very iconic evergreens. However, they can be very old. So a 15-foot, 20-foot pinyon pine tree, which is one that's reached full maturity, can be 100 years old, can be 200 years old. They can be even 300 years old at heights that don't seem as impressive to us as something like the giant sequoias. Juniper trees, I was just, as a way to talk about this, I was just looking up something. I was trying to understand the traditional uses of juniper berries, what humans have used juniper berries for a long time. And junipers, different species of junipers exist around the world. And I just happened upon the first article I found was around London, England, and they were talking about junipers as a shrub. And I think that as Europeans came to dominate the Great Basin, this notion of a juniper tree as a simple shrub really took hold. And juniper trees, like pinyon pines, a 10-foot, a 12-foot juniper tree could also be 200 years old. And this is it becomes very important to know that, because one of the things that ranchers and BLM and the Forest Service say is that these trees aren't very tall, so they must not be very old, so therefore they must be invasive, so therefore we must cut them. Where in reality they don't reach the same heights that we associate with the more iconic trees. That doesn't mean that they're not, truly ancient trees.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the BLM document.
Right. So the notice from the Carson City Sierra Front field office lists three very common justifications for clear cutting pinyon juniper forests, and I'll read them. They're quoted verbatim. So the BLM thinks it has to clear cut these forests to reduce the potential of large-scale, high-severity wildland fire and provide for public and firefighter safety and protection of property and infrastructure. Another reason they offer is to maintain sagebrush habitat, riparian plant communities, wet meadows, and springs. And then finally, and this is sort of the cause célèbre, this is the most fashionable justification right now. The BLM says it must address threats to greater sage grouse from invasive annual grasses, wildfires, and conifer expansion. So the BLM must clear cut healthy, living, in many cases, ancient forests to think that they will save one species, the greater sage grouse.
Which is primarily threatened by oil and gas development, etc.
Absolutely. When I was reading about this and really trying to understand it, I thought, maybe I've lived long enough to realize that I shouldn't take the government's word for face value. And so instead of trusting them about what are the threats to greater sage grouse, I thought, why don't I find out what the threats to greater sage grouse are? And straight from the World Wildlife Fund, they say that the threats to greater sage grouse are, like you just said, oil and gas development, conversion of land for agricultural use, which is ranching, climate change, and human development. And in a place like the Great Basin, where a city like Los Angeles just keeps growing out and out and out, we can see that it's not actually greater sage grouse, but humans. I think that's a classic practice that this culture uses. Instead of humans being the problem, we have to scapegoat anything else to draw attention away from human in.
So do you want to debunk those three?
Yeah, I think I can do it pretty quickly. I think the first one, to reduce the potential of large-scale, high-severity wildland fire, the truth is, first, from a common-sense perspective, much of these justifications are produced by scientists who are members of a colonial settler class. And when they say that there's a potential for large-scale, high-severity wildland fire, they don't have a way of looking past records of, say, 1870s or 1880s when European settlers settled en masse in the Great Basin. So they simply haven't lived here long enough to know what is a normal wildfire cycle for pinyon juniper forests, and yet they pass it off like we need to cut these forests in order to prevent fires. But more specifically, we do know that when pinyon juniper forests are cut, annual grasses, invasive annual grasses, fill the void that's left after the forests are cut. And those exotic grasses, grasses like cheatgrass, are much more flammable than the forests are themselves. So when they're talking about wanting to prevent wildfires, then they cut a forest, they're actually making the land much more flammable than it otherwise would be.
Well, and in any case, I'm sorry, I've lived my entire life in the West, and fires are a part of the West. And if you're going to live in the West, then, and if you're going to live in forests in the West, then you're going to, I mean, they are fire dependent. And is that true for pinyon and juniper too? Do fires routinely come through there? Is that part of their natural? I mean, for God's sake, there's a species of woodpecker called the black-backed woodpecker who has developed a black back because it primarily lives in forests that have been burned. That's why the back is black. And I mean, is fire part of the normal regime of a pinyon juniper forest?
Yes, fire. In an environment like the Great Basin, where you have sub-long, hot, dry summers, and you have the potential for things like lightning storms to come through, for example. These forests have adapted to the fact that every once in a while lightning is going to strike and create wildfires. But I think the thing that is really, I guess, really important that I want to communicate is the scientists are routinely saying we just don't know what the actual intervals for these wildfires were. We don't have enough records in the past. And, oh, by the way, most of the holders of knowledge that extended hundreds of years into the past were murdered by the same forces that want the pinyon juniper forest cut. And by that, I'm saying European settlers in the form of mining interest and ranching interest had a vested interest in eliminating indigenous peoples in the Great Basin. And so the only people that have any memory of wildfire intervals beyond 1860, 1870, 1880, many of these people, were murdered. Which just fits very classic colonial processes around the world. But it's easy to see in the Great Basin as you look through the lens of pinyon juniper deforestation.
Okay, so that's the first one. What about the second rationale for deforestation?
Yeah, so the second one was this specific office, the Sierra Front Field Office of the Carson City District, said that they want to cut pinyon juniper forests so that they can maintain sagebrush habitat, riparian plant communities, wet meadows, and springs. And this argument is based off of a theory that is commonly in pinyon juniper circles called the encroachment theory. And what this relies on, BLM and the Forest Service and their scientists say that pinyon juniper forests are encroaching and invading lands that they traditionally didn't actually live on. The way that they're doing this is they're using pictures, again, from the 1880s, 1890s, where they'll show a picture of a hill outside of Eureka, Nevada, for example, that doesn't have any pinyon junipers on it, and now it has pinyon junipers on it, and they say, well, those trees didn't traditionally live here, so we have to cut them. What this whole...
Of course, there are also interstate highways didn't traditionally exist in the Great Basin either, but let's leave that aside. Or cows.
Yeah, absolutely. The horrible thing about this, or the key to understanding this whole theory, is understanding settler history within the Great Basin. So, in the 1860s, silver was discovered in Nevada. Cities, whole cities sprung up quite literally overnight. This is the classic boom or bust mining story that has characterized so many parts of the American West. But the Great Basin is a classic example of this. So, like I said, silver was discovered. Whole towns sprang up overnight. Well, there we know that mining took a lot of the wood, and there have been in the last 20 or 30 years some great academic and research efforts to discover just how much deforestation happened in the 1860s and 1870s along with the mining. There's a great book by a really delightful man named Ronald Lanner. He wrote a book called The Pinyon Pine, A Natural and Cultural History. And part of what he did was to set out to undermine this encroachment theory. And he learned everything he could about smelting operations in Nevada. And smelting is the process by which silver is separated from ore. And it requires a huge amount of heat to separate that silver from the ore. And the way that they generated this heat was by burning charcoal. And the way that they gained this charcoal was by cutting down huge forests to gain the wood to make the charcoal. Well, in places like Eureka, Nevada, the only forests that were available are pinyon juniper forests. And I've got a quote here where Lanner just completely, he explains exactly what happens. And I'm going to read the quote because I think it's so powerful to understand the mass of destruction that happened. Lanner says, a typical yield of pinyon pine was 10 cords per acre, and a cord made about 30 bushels of charcoal. So the furnaces of Eureka, working at capacity, could in a single day devour over 530 cords of pinyon, the produce of over 50 acres. An additional 20 acres a day were being cut to provide cord for the mills. After 1 year of major activity, the hills around Eureka were bare of trees for 10 miles in every direction. By 1874, the wasteland extended 20 miles from town, and by 1878, the woodland was nowhere closer than 50 miles from Eureka. Every acre had been picked clean.
So what you're saying is that the encroachment rationale is a straight-up lie.
Yes. It's... Yeah, it's a straight up lie.
So what's really happening is the juniper pinyon are just re-inhabiting slowly the land that was taken from them.
Yes, the land is healing itself. And I think it's...
Well, for God's sake, the BLM has to stop that.
Well, yeah, especially because these trees are competing with their livestock for forage land. And that, I think what's so devastating to me about this is, if you just, I read that Lanner quote and I say things like 10 cords per acre, 530 cords of pinyon, which was over 50 acres, and that in one day, 20 acres could be cut to provide cordwood for the mills. And these are all numbers. These are all, what I'm getting at is picture yourself standing in front of that hill in 1878. I can do this myself. So like I said, in Nevada, in November, I was just there, and for the first time in my life, I saw a pinyon juniper clear cut. And the first thing that came to my mind was scenes of human massacres that I've seen, where you see bodies stacked, you see mangled limbs and corpses, and we call the branches of trees, tree limbs. And so I look out across a 35-acre clear cut, for example, and you see trees stacked on each other. You see once living wood splintered and chipped and cracked. And it's the BLM. There are people doing this. The BLM... there are humans that are so confused about, well, I don't want to use the word confused. There are humans that have lied to themselves so thoroughly, that they can drive two crawler tractors with chains stretched between them and rip up every living thing in their path and then say that they're doing it to protect, riparian plant communities, wet meadows and springs.
So say that, basically say that again and expand a little bit on it, that people who don't live in Nevada might not have heard the word chaining.
Yeah, so chaining, the most common way that the BLM's vegetation treatment projects are performed is through a process called chaining. And chaining happens when BLM or the Forest Service, they take a U.S. Navy battleship's anchor chain. So let's just think about the metaphor there. They take a U.S. Navy battle chain and they stretch it between two crawler tractors, which are huge tractors that have big they're big tractors that crush everything beneath their own tracks. And they stretch that train across the two tractors and they drive parallel to each other and drag the forest floor. And the chain is so long and the tractor is so strong that it literally rips up everything that the chain hits by its roots. And to visit a clear cut in the Great Basin is to see these healthy pinyon juniper forests stretching across the lower parts of the mountains, and then you'll just see these very random, very irrational swaths just cut with no apparent logic, just cut through the forest. Of course, chaining is the most common way they do it. They also kill forests with herbicides, which are often chemical injections right into the trees. And then another one that I find to really demonstrate what's going on, they have these machines called masticators. And to masticate is to chew something. And so I always think about BLM as literally eating these forests with their masticating machines. And the masticators crush the trees and grind them into a pulp, basically.
You know, it's atrocities like this that always remind me that this culture really has a death urge, and this is destruction for the sake of destruction. I mean, they can have all these claims to virtue that they want. I want you to talk about claims to virtue in a moment, but I mean, underlying all of it is just this is destruction. This is not even destruction for the smelters, which is bad enough. This is destruction for the sake of destruction.
Yes, I completely agree. The way I've articulated it before is that this culture is on a path of suicide, but I also add the murder-suicide part. It is clearly suicidal to, in a place like the Great Basin, where so much of, where every natural community really depends upon these pinyon juniper forests. But more than the suicidal part, is this culture wants to take down everything with it. It wants to murder everything, and then it'll turn the gun on itself. And I think one way I understand this is, I guess, in my own personal life through my own experiences with mental health issues like depression and attempted suicides. I personally got to a point where I became convinced by the dominant culture that there was nothing sacred left in the world, that everything was just material, and that the sacred had been removed for me. And I think that this dominant culture long ago, you know, 10,000 years ago, sold real connection to the natural world for material comforts, for I don't know what. And now it hates itself, and now it wants, when it sees something sacred, I've heard a pinyon pine described, the pinyon pine is as sacred to the indigenous peoples of the Great Basin as bison are to the peoples of the plains, or Sam and R to the peoples of the Pacific Northwest. And this dominant culture, I think, is jealous of that humans can have that connection and recognize that sacredness, and so it's doing everything it can to wipe it out.
Well, thank you for that. And I think both you and I owe a strong debt to Robert J. Lifton. And can you talk about, it was actually, honestly, my understanding of the whole Claims to Virtue came in 1995 when I was asked to write an essay about, one of the Claims to Virtue you mentioned, about deforestation in order to prevent forest fires. And I'm sitting here thinking for days and days and days, and I couldn't get anywhere on why would they do this? It's just so crazy. And then, okay, you take over with Robert J. Lifton.
Yeah, so thank you for connecting yourself to that, because the reason I know about Robert J. Lifton is from reading your work, and the way I knew about him was from his book, The Nazi Doctors. So Robert J. Lifton dedicated his career to understanding how something like the rise of Nazism could happen, and how the German people, I guess, people who performed functions within the Nazi Party could convince themselves that what they are doing was acceptable. And he, one place, I found an article that Lifton wrote that appeared in the New York Times, I think it was in 2014, and he wrote this article called The Climate Swerve, and he applied what he learned about the Nazis to climate change deniers. And I think in that article, he wrote a sentence that I felt like was sort of the thesis for his whole career. And he wrote, "Over the course of my work, I have come to the realization that it is very difficult to endanger or kill large numbers of people except with a claim to virtue. And that claim to virtue is often a way that people who are about to commit atrocities recharacterize what they're going to do. So, you know, Derek, I've heard you say this a lot, but so how could doctors working in Nazi death camps who had taken the Hippocratic Oath to do everything they could for their patients, how could they participate in those death camps after having taken those Hippocratic Oaths? And they have to rationalize that in some way. But it's also, you know, Hitler and the Nazi Party, they weren't sending 6 million Jews to their death in the concentration camps. They were purifying the Aryan race. And that claim to virtue is the recharacterization that those who will commit atrocities apply to their actions. And I thought, you could apply Lifton's thesis and his idea of a claim to virtue when he says that he has come to the realization that it's very difficult to endanger or kill large numbers of people except with the claim of virtue. I would extend that realization to the natural world and say something like BLM's justification stand as their claims to virtue, clearing their conscience before they murder millions of trees and all the beings that depend on those forests. And so the only way that BLM can cut millions of acres of pinyon juniper forests is to claim that they are protecting the public and firefighters, or enhancing historic juniper woodland habitat, or addressing threats to greater sage grouse. They have to recharacterize the atrocities that they're going to commit as an actual good. And that's the only way that their psyches can handle what they're about to do.
So we have about 10 minutes left. That's a while. So there's a couple main questions I want to ask. One of them, and you can address these whatever order you want, and if I come up with more questions, then we'll do those too. But one question is, what can people do about this? What you've presented some information about terrible things. What can people who live in anywhere from Nova Scotia to Mississippi to Carlin, Nevada, what can they do? Actually, I got three questions. One question is going to be that. One question is going to be,
why do you love pinyon / juniper forest so much? What is it that speaks to you so much about them? I mean, I'm known for loving salmon, and honestly, one of the reasons is because I live here, but there are other reasons too, which I maybe could articulate, maybe not. So why do you love it so much? And then the third question is very simple, which is when I lived in Carlin, Nevada, it was all sagebrush around there. Was that historically pinyon pine too, or was that not? Do you know? Carlin's about 20 miles west of Elko, so it's northeastern. Was that pinyon pine forest too, pinyon juniper forest too?
I think it probably was. I think that, I mean, the amount of destruction that happened to these forests is like Lanner's quote that I read shows, like it was massive and almost incomprehensible how fast these forests were. So it very well could have been. I think the scientists also always say that before we can undermine the encroachment theory or say that pinyon junipers didn't exist here, we have to do very site-specific analyses. And I think that, you know, that's a cautious way of answering your question. I think it's more than likely that that there were trees there, and sometime in the last 130, 140 years, they were clear cut, and we just don't really have the memory to say.
Okay, so what about whatever order you want, why/how do you love them so much, and what can people do?
So I'll answer the first one. Why do I love them so much?
As opposed to, I don't know, saguaro cactuses or something.
Right. So I want to, one thing that I'm very cautious of in, with the world as, with every living system around the world in decline, you can find something to protect everywhere. And so I don't know if the question, is necessarily why do I love juniper forests more than something else? It's that I love life, and the murder of pinyon juniper forest is so consistently in my face in the Great Basin that it compels me to defend them. But that being said, I do love pinyon juniper forests. To walk through a valley and up a mountainside in the Great Basin, and to experience a day where you go from the brutal cold to the heat of midday on a valley floor, and stand next to the silvers and greens and the pure smell of pinyon pine needles, and to smell that ancient fragrance of juniper trees, and to see the big blue bunches of berries hanging from that, and to know that those trees, since humans occupied the Great Basin, however long ago that was, 12,000 years ago or forever, according to indigenous peoples, and to know that those trees have supported humans, to causes just such a deep feeling of love in me, that it's a connection to a past that gives me some sort of spiritual grounding, I guess, and I'll, you know, then physically gives me the imperative to protect them. But what can people do about pinyon juniper deforestation? Well, quite specifically, I think the local BLM field offices that are responsible for carrying out the treatment projects. And I believe that those field offices are very susceptible to public opinion. I think, man, this is not enough time to go into this, but if the occupation at Mall here and what the Bundys showed us is that BLM might very well acquiesce to some of these pressures. And I think that I don't know if we're at a time where people need to pick up automatic weapons and wave them in the face of BLM, but I do think that if we can generate some, a lot of public pressure on them through, through the media, through commenting periods, we could slow down this destruction and ultimately, try and gain a moratorium where pinyon juniper forests aren't being cut.
Are there groups or organizations, who are working, to stop this form of deforestation?
Yes. I'm part of a coalition of people living throughout the West. It's made up primarily of members from a group called Wildlands Defense, who's done great work, and then members of Deep Green Resistance, a place that people can go to follow what's going on. We have a Facebook page called Protect Pinyon Juniper Forests. On that Facebook page, we have a petition that currently has over 62,000 supporters. And what we want from that petition is people's contact info so that we can start to organize and mobilize people, especially to get people physically present at these offices at crucial times. And then finally, at the website, deepgreenresistancegreatbasin.org, that's all one word, we have an email newsletter sign up where people can go on, sign up, and get updates about what's going on. I guess in the near future, over Memorial Day weekend, my friend Max Wilbert is organizing. He's calling it, I believe, the Sacred Water and Sacred Forest Camp, and it's going to be several days in Nevada where we travel through the Great Basin and talk about various ecological threats to life there, including the Southern Nevada Water Authority's water grab and pinyon juniper deforestation.
Well, thank you. We have like 1 minute left. Is there anything else that you want to say that I haven't given you the opportunity? And if not, I do have one more question.
How about you go with the question?
Well, the question is, and this may be too big a question for 1 minute, but you've talked about how the language of pinyon juniper forests. And what do these forests say to you?
Stop the murdering, however you can. When I look at a clear cut and I see the destruction happening, the only thing that I can hear is stop. And I want us to stop it. And I know those trees want to survive. So the most important thing is we got to stop the destruction of these amazing forests.
Well, thank you so much for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Will Falk. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.